Thank you very much. Yeah, so it's really great to be back here. Well, everyone keeps asking me if it's my first visit, and it's my first visit in something like 8 years. So effectively, yes, I don't remember anything except getting lost from my previous visit. So so it's very nice to be back here and see some familiar faces, and I'm going to talk to you about 170817, the gravitational wave observation from a neutron star merger last August, and specifically how we are trying to decipher what that gravitational wave signature is telling us about dense matter, nuclear density and above, and why that sort of comes into play. So I wanted to give you something of an introduction just to sort of set the scene. So we're considering here, So we're considering here some mergers, which are so far the signal that LIGO has been able to detect. And the signature of a merger at a given distance will depend on the mass of the merger. So these are all systems at a fixed distance. They're coming in, starting at low frequency, spiraling together up to a merger. The merger frequency depends on the mass of the system. And so the neutron stars are the lowest mass system, and at a fixed distance, they're going to be the weakest of the gravitational wave signals here. But they're also expected to be more numerous. However, as it turned out, the rates per volume plus the larger horizon for binary black holes has meant that the first detections from LIGO were black hole detections. So these are just spectra from the gravitational wave data from all the different black hole papers. So you'll see these are all less than a second up to a couple seconds of time frequency plot, and there's sort of normalized by the amount of energy in each of these time frequency bins, and you see the chirp-like in spiral patterns highlighted. And so for some of these low mass systems, so this one has actually a faint chirp, which is not really visible by eye in the data, but this is not actually how we detect gravitational waves. So that's not a problem. We're just kind of got lucky that we've got a lot of loud things that are visible in these sorts of spectrograms. So we're starting to map out then a population of binary black holes. And here's simulations from all those binary black holes, or at least masses and spins compatible with the observations. And we have some low mass ones that are smaller, some unequal mass ones, some larger ones, all merging in sort of half a second to a couple seconds in LIGO's field of frequencies that we can actually distinguish fluctuations from noise. So the August signal. And after the first binary black hole, I went around saying, well, of course we see this in the spectrogram, but we'll never be able to do that for a neutron star merger because they're far too weak and the power is spread out over many, many, many frequencies. And so, and that was actually pretty true for Hanford, but you could even see this chirp there. But we have here 30 seconds of time frequency plot here where you can actually see the signal by eye, which was not, I mean, shocking, really. And so this is immediately coming from a different class of systems than the binary black hole observations. So this is sort of a fun comparison animation I'd like to show. So these waveforms are generated by finding the best fit parameters for each of the systems, starting them all off at the same frequency. So this is not directly pulled from the data. It's an interpretation based on parameter estimation from the data. And you can start to see here with the binary black holes, based on the mass scale of the object, starting at 30 hertz, we'll have the low mass things like 150914, which only have a few cycles before they merge. The high mass things, the low mass things like 170608, have many more cycles and band, and then are typically harder to distinguish any particular cycle by eye. And then we have 170817, which just keeps going until it merges at a different cycle. So this is a bit of a challenge for the data analysis, because 170817 has thousands of gravitational wave cycles between sort of 30 hertz to around 1,000 hertz, where we lose track of what's going on. However, most of those cycles, from the perspective of trying to model the system, are really on the boring side. So what I mean by that is the dynamics of about 55 point, however many seconds there are, it's only in the very last seconds that things begin to act differently than just two-point particles orbiting each other. Now, there's mass and spin, and those things are really cool, and people care about them, and I shouldn't be so dismissive. But the really exciting stuff, from my perspective, kind of comes in most dramatically. So this is a numerical simulation video in the last sort of 30 milliseconds. So this is the final stages of the waveform, the final orbits before the things move. The stars are beginning to be distorted by the companion's tidal field. They disrupt each other, they collapse, they throw off a lot of matter. And all this post-merger signature here, well, actually, even the final orbits of the gravitational wave, this is something that we can infer from the starting wave conditions we observe and some assumptions about what's going on in the system. This is not something as yet we have been able to actually observe in the data. So at those high frequencies, we have too much noise in the detector so far to be able to see the fate of our system. Fortunately, though, for 170817, we were able to step one, because of the mass scale and the amplitude, figure out the distance. And then step two, start to combine information like the relative timing to get to the two observatories that saw it to start to figure out the sky position. So this is kind of what you are able to do first. This one narrow circle is the Hanford and Livingston timing circle. So the relative arrival time in both of those sets a direction that's sort of symmetrical around the line connecting the two detectors. And then there's also a rapid analysis, which pinned down the distance first by Hanford and Livingston only. Adding in Virl made it more precise. And then follow-ups after the rapid analysis gave us an even better level of precision. Timing is the story we usually tell, and the main idea that we think of to fix the location of a signal from gravitational wave observations. But the sky location also has a really important feature of the detector-dependent strain. And for this signal, that was really Virgo's contribution. So the Virgo signal was on the border of being a signal and an absence of signal. It was actually really one of the human check hang-ups on the detection day, was that the Virgo signal was weaker than you might have expected given the loudness of the Hanford and Livingston signal. So here's the noise in the three detectors as a function of frequency. These are the amplitudes recovered by Hanford and Livingston. And then if you take the Virgo, so this is a matched filter recovery. Virgo is actually inferred from the sky position and reconstructed. And it's, as you can see, for this particular sky position, it's really low compared to the length of the noise. So Virgo's impact was sort of a narrowing of that timing window to regions of that loop where Virgo had less sky sensitivity. Anyway, though, that was enough to identify an EM counterpart. First off, helped by the fact that there was a coincident gamma ray burst observed at the same time as the initial automated trigger for, 2 seconds after the initial automated trigger recorded by the system, and then telescope follow-ups around 11 hours later, once the sun set over the observatories that were able to observe it, were able to identify a counterpart, which has a really fun story of X-ray and gamma ray and UV and optical and infrared and radio observations, which are still ongoing as this ejected matter from the collision plows off into the interstellar medium. Okay. So that this is sort of the big picture of what this event was. And the perspective I wanted to focus on today is where we see the signature of dense matter in this. So what we're doing is really treating this observation as an astrophysical collider that has taken these two dense objects and collided them together. And that's giving us a probe of the phase space that we can actually compare the phase space of quark matter interactions that you can actually compare with other colliders. So this is a three-dimensional phase space. So there's the density. So the density of a nucleus is here. Nuclei live here. Temperatures depend, can be measured in MeV, and sort of normal matter is at relatively low temperature. The LHC is up here at low density and very high energies. Other heavy ion colliders end up with the starting point being when the things hit each other, and then they settle back down towards the regime of nuclei. Neutron stars have two differences. So one thing that we'll see is when our neutron stars start, they are asymmetric. There are more neutrons than protons. So this is a different interaction of region of the phase space. And I'll project them back onto this other one because I can't draw three-dimensional things very well and I want to modify this later. So we see neutron stars at rest are effectively zero temperature and potentially have some sort of transition to interesting phases of quark matter that we're not aware of. So this is very uncertain what's going on exactly and whether or not there is a phase transition from that critical point that reaches or is reached by the family of neutron stars. And then as they collide, the stars will increase in energy. The temperature of the merged object and its post-merger can be comparable to, can potentially be probing additional interesting regions of the phase space. And then the neutron star matter also returns to nuclei, and this is the whole ejecta, the kilonova, the production of heavy elements in our universe. So now the part that I'm gonna actually focus on is the part we've been able to observe in the gravitational wave signal, which is this initial step before the stars collided. So there's sort of three phases, and there's lots of interesting information from those arrows right now. But the starting point is sort of set by the equation of state of matter that's cold, that thermal effects can be neglected for the energy scales of the particle interactions, and is in beta equilibrium. So all reaction times are presumed to go to completion. The matter, these reaction times are rapid enough that this acts as a perfect fluid. We can neglect viscosity and things like that. And we have the fundamental uncertain property of this is what the pressure as a function of density is in the core of the star. So nuclear density here and above is where this sort of regime of uncertainty is. And nuclear density is more uncertain for neutron stars because they're no longer protons and neutrons together, but primarily neutron star matter, primarily neutron matter, probably. So each of these candidate equations of state gives us a family of neutron stars. We assume that one equation of state describes all neutron stars, although you can try and test that if you have multiple observations. And then given that equation of state, then you'll get, say, a relationship between the mass of the star and the radius of the star, which people have spent decades trying to pin down and constrain by various astronomical observations. So where does this come into the gravitational wave observation of merging neutron stars? So for 170817, so I'm again doing one of these frequency on the plot and the amplitude in particularly weird units that you shouldn't need to worry about too much, but it's just an amplitude of both the noise fluctuations as they were at the time of 170817. So at 170817, Livingston had pretty good low frequency sensitivity, but a bit more of a gap at high frequency because of issues with the high powered laser exploding. And that was before the observing run. And then 170817, then these are signals that have the right amplitude and the chirp mass and things as 170817 does. And then we stitch them on to simulations like that one I showed earlier for the last 30 seconds, 30 milliseconds. And the last 30 milliseconds is approximately this whole chunk of frequency. So because of the chirping thing, we have this, minutes potentially in band starting from somewhere around 10 or 20 hertz. But the frequency with time accelerates rapidly with the chirp. And so the last 2 seconds, say, start here, and then the last milliseconds start here. And this is really sort of the final cycles of the in-spiral or the merger, or however you want to define it, that we see. So describing this, then, we have most of the in-spiral is effectively these point particles. So the matter effect is insignificant. The tidal signature begins to creep in, depending on how large the stars are, at roughly sort of hundreds of hertz. And then the stars collide in the sort of intermediate regime. And then we have something we call the post-merger, which it's not very clearly highlighted with this screen, but is these sort of complicated looking peaks up here. And as we change the equation of state, so here we have stars that are large versus stars that are small. As the stars get more compact, they act more like black holes. They spiral together further before they merge, and they oscillate at higher frequencies when you have a merging remnant. And based on 170817, actually, these first two scenarios have been disfavored. So we think we're in the side of compact stars.
So do you remember what the rough SNR is of the post-merger?
At design sensitivity, it depends on the model. And for something comparable to, it depends on the model and it depends on the simulation. But it would be, unfortunately, something like, so I know something for an effective distance of 100 would be roughly a SNR of a half or less. But 170817 was an effective distance of around 70 or so. So borderline comparable to noise function.
Isn't it a bit of a mistake to talk about SNR? Because if you don't have a template, then even if you have the high SNR, but you don't know what it is that has a high SNR, then it's just some random thing.
Right. So to actually detect these things, you need to do something like a weighted model independent comparison. So the typical, or one of the methods I'm most familiar with involves like a wavelet decomposition, and you try and see whether you match the fluctuations in the data stream with correlated wavelets between the two. So you get some sort of power in that if it's a gravitational waves thing, it would affect the two detectors in a predictable and coherent way. And you can actually get a little extra information from that coherence that helps compensate for the fact that you don't have that you don't have
a deterministic waveform.
Yeah. But so I think some of those folks have suggested that if 170817 had occurred with design sensitivity, and it was one of the more favorable models, which unfortunately are disfavored by the tides, then it could have been, you know, a weak detection. So it's sort of really on the borderline. But really, for making sort of regular observations of post-merger, folks are typically considering going into sort of a next generation observatory or a substantial upgrade from the current observatories. Because it would be it seems very improbable that 17 or 817 is not one of the strongest things that's out there. Okay. Sorry. So now, what was I going to say for this? So the general setup we have in these in-spirals is the early in-spiral is driven by something that we can describe in a sort of semi-analytical fashion by just comparing the energy of the orbital system as a function of the separation of the objects and the frequency of the gravitational waves, and then the energy loss due to gravitational waves and doing some sort of energy balance. And this is how we set up sort of these chirp waveforms, which show a decreasing in energy loss, a decreasing orbital radius, and increasing frequency. And this, as you can see, has the mass a particular chirp mass of the two objects driving it, and then effects from spin and mass ratio both come in actually at the same correction order in this expansion, and then tides come in several orders beyond that. One of the things that this means is actually that masses and spins are somewhat strongly correlated in how they affect the waveform, and that makes a big difference in how we choose to analyze and understand the data. So this is this is recovered masses of the system. So here what we have is something where we have the two masses there. It starts here, this dashed line is an equal mass system. We assume here that the M2 is the smaller of the two and M1 is the larger of the two. So this is not disfavored if you look at these probability densities. It's actually extremely compatible with an equal mass system of about 1.35 solar masses, which is pretty much the most boring neutron star system you can possibly have imagined going in. So, well, I mean, that's what it is, which is cool, actually, if you're trying to convince yourself this was a binary neutron star. But because of the degeneracy between mass and spin, in part, and just because higher order things are harder to pin down, we have this really long tail going with increasing mass ratio along a line of constant chirp mass through the mass-mass relay. Now, one thing is if we make very minimal assumptions about the spin, mostly what we do is we rule out most of the phase space except some regions of the phase space that are actually really hard to see in their effect on the gravitational wave signal. The particular combination, this is showing the spins of the two objects and their tilt. And if they're both tilted like this, you actually have you have an effective zero contribution to the phasing at leading order, so you have to go to the next order to kind of rule that out. So this is sort of an artifact of our assumptions about what spins are likely that we see that weird alignment angle. One of the things that we do then is to just because we observe neutron stars in our galaxy and they tend to be spinning with slow spins, we can just artificially impose that the spins must be astrophysically small. And then we tighten up towards equal mass. Equal mass gets more relatively favored. And we see that the spins tend to be favoring an aligned configuration as opposed to anti-aligned, which also kind of maps to what your expectations of an astrophysical system. But all this information is coming mostly before those last 30 milliseconds. And so what we want to focus on is actually, in particular, the region of from a bit before this up to the point where the two stars collide, which is roughly the peak amplitude. But unfortunately, since it's currently obscured by noise, we're not going to be talking about what happens after that. So as they're in spiraling, the response of the given neutron star we characterize by how much it deforms as a ratio with the strength of the external tidal field. So this can be sort of a polarization of the matter in the star or the deformability of the matter inside the star induced by a tidal field. Now, each of the equations of state that you might consider here showing radius, so we have these are the mass radius curves put on their side the way they really should be, even though no one plots them that way, except for people from my research advisors group. Anyway, so here we have a range of masses. Different equations of state have either large radii or small radii. And primarily in concert with the radius of the star, the tidal deformability, or the ratio of the deformation to the particular kind of tidal field, is also larger to smaller for different proposals for how matter behaves in the core of the stars. So this is, I should emphasize, a perturbative calculation right now, but it's defining a fixed parameter for a given star from the mass of the star.
Well, what's the difference between what you call model and fit?
That is from a parameterization of the equation of state. So this is details of the paper that I pulled this from, where they were looking at parameterized equation of state and how they could reconstruct the true properties of the equation of state from.
And it's fit to what? What is it?
It is the equation of state fit to a model of the equation of state.
It's fit to data. No, it's fit to.
So is it that you have just a parameterized model for an equation of a state? So instead of using the full, I guess, nuclear physics calculation, you use some sort of parametric model.
Exactly. Yeah. So this figure I was just using to illustrate it comes from an exploration of a parametric model for the equation of state function itself, and how well that model could reproduce the full nuclear physics calculations for this given.
Okay, but that's nothing to do with data.
Not yet. We're actually going to use a parameterized model later, but we're not quite there. So now if we put this into our energy balance equation, what we see are there's two primary effects that each generate an acceleration of the n spiral. So first off, the energy at a given separation is changed by the extra energy required to deform the stars. And secondly, the deformed stars also have their own quadrupole moment, so they give a little bit of extra radiation. The upshot of all this is as you change the equation of state inside the star, you get a different waveform. So the green one is the most extreme. A very large star is actually, even before 30 seconds, it's offset from the family of other candidates here, and it will merge. You know, it will have offsets in the cycles that sort of decoheres well before the merger. Most equation of state models, though, are a little more subtle to detangle, which is why we also need to worry about what's going on at the merger. So I know folks here have some expertise in this, but the general idea is that we can also do full numerical simulations in general relativity of merging neutron stars. And we see a sort of extrapolation of the tidal interaction through to their interactions as the stars collide and merge. Compact stars will merge at higher frequency and look more like black holes. Large radius stars collide earlier. They merge at lower frequency. And one of the surprises of the last, or maybe not surprises, but one of the things that we have managed to work out over the last years is that although these simulations are no longer linear, the stars are no longer just slightly perturbed, their interactions are no longer just leading order tidal interactions, the properties that you can extract that characterize the merger waveforms of the stars also map cleanly to this inspiral parameter for the two stars. In particular, you can compare it to say, do we want to talk about the star's radius and how they collide? And no, you actually want to talk about their tidal deformability. As yet, we have found that numerical functions of the star's tidal deformabilities are sufficient to describe the variation in the waveform patterns we see, and that if you compare two equations of state that give the same tidal deformability, but possibly different other parameters, they also have the same waveform to within the numerical accuracy we've been able to compare them so far. So this motivates today's waveform models. And to be fair, you know, this is something that is actively a systematic limitation of the ability of this understanding of neutron star matter. But we are able to improve, we can take our inspiral model and phenomenologically extend it to the merger by comparing it with numerical simulations and using the same inspiral parameter to characterize it. So we're developing a understanding of neutron star merger that maps onto this single parameter. Now that's maybe annoying because this is a rich interaction between two objects with many effects and it's only coming down to one number, but at least it gives us a chance of measuring that one number. So there's trade-offs there. So what were we able to actually do by generating, you know, millions of these waveform models, varying their tidal parameters, comparing them to the gravitational wave strain data? And just as we have posterior distributions for the masses and the spins, we can see what we get for the constraints from the gravitational wave signal on the deformability of each of those stars. So this is now the deformability of the larger star, the deformability of the smaller star in particular units. And the regions of parameter space that were allowed by the discovery paper is sort of this whole region below the yellow bar. And then we have an updated properties paper which pinned things down more towards the compact side here with this red bar. And then finally, we'll have a common equation of state assumption, a set of paper that I'll talk about, which restricts things further down below these blue and green bars, with the favored values tending to be very compact. And for each of these, we can compare to an equation of state model. So for a given equation of state model, you would start with an equal mass pair of stars having equal tidal parameters and sweep up with unequal masses to some family of stars compatible with the mass data. And then you can compare that with the tidal deformation data and see whether or not this is compatible, or like these folks up here and this guy now after our initial constraint is disfavored by the data. So this was the first thing we were able to do in the few weeks before the announcement. And then we've been since been able to improve various features of the analysis to tighten that bound up. And then if we assume some more things about the equation of state, we get additional information. So one thing to emphasize, though, is that our measurement as correlations within the measurement. So this is just showing that the mass ratio and the effective spin of the system are very correlated. So the blue is the full analysis where we don't restrict the spin. The orange is the analysis where we assume the magnitude of the spins is small. And you can see how that tightens up the range of mass ratios that are allowed. Similarly, if we don't assume spins are small, we get this large swath of possible tidal parameters, which in particular intersects with of tidal parameter values of zero, which correspond to black holes. So from the gravitational wave data alone, we cannot confidently say that 170817 was not a merger of two primordial black holes that were the masses of typical neutron stars. If we assume they're neutron stars, and we assume that they have spin properties like neutron stars, then we can see that they're still really on the compact side compared to different scenarios, but we can only distinguish them from a black hole waveform with those particular assumptions. So I'm going to probably skip over a little bit some of the details of how this is done, but one of the next step we can do to sort of improve, maybe not improve, but so to say something useful about the tidal parameter, the first step is to assume things are neutron stars. But the other thing that we can do, or that they have neutron star-like properties, the other thing that we can do is to assume that they're both described by the same equation of state, which is a pretty standard assumption that you would make looking at neutron stars astrophysically. But what that does is it links lambda 1 and lambda 2 in our sampling, and that gives tighter constraints on the combined properties of the stars. Yeah.
What do you mean by saying that the objects are distinguishable from black holes? We have no knowledge of what's inside.
Right, so this, one thing that I should have clarified earlier when I was talking about that tidal deformability parameter is to, at least with some specific limitations on how we define that parameter, it's zero for a black hole, and that effect on the waveform is zero for a black hole. When I talk about, say, favoring a non-zero value of this parameter, that is an observation of an effect on the waveform that is not present for binary black holes.
So you only have one selection method?
Well, of course, you know, people also have the electromagnetic observations, and those don't suggest that there was two black holes merging.
There's also the issue about the remnant. Is it the lightest black hole we've ever seen? Or is it the most massive neutron stars? What about that result?
So that's something that the gravitational wave signal alone cannot tell us right now, specifically because our constraints on the equation of state are wide enough that we could encompass both, I think. Pretty sure. It's a bit tricky, actually, because we keep these large radius stars are the ones that are more likely to be able to support a 2.7-ish solar mass neutron star. So
we haven't seen bright neutron stars with a mass bigger than 2 solar masses.
Right, but the remnant would be closer to 2.5 solar masses.
But I thought you already ruled them out, right?
If we assume they're neutron star, it's a fairly weak. I should clarify. This is about the inspiraling components, that they are not black holes. But does the remnant collapse to a black hole? How long does that take? Or could it be a stable neutron star? That's
what I'm asking. But I mean, the question I said that you do that, aren't those the ones that you need to?
Yes, I think so. That's why. The challenge, though, is to, and this comes back a little bit later. So the challenge is how you want to go from the equation of state density range that we observe to the one required to know about the properties of a maximum mass star. And there are arguments on whether or not there are ways to start with a compact star and then still support maximum mass of stars. Actually, I mean, if I didn't know anything about observed maximum masses and I took this kind of deformability, I might think that it would be a stretch even to support 2.3 solar mass.
You can.
You can, yes.
Okay.
But it's becoming challenging. But then people also have clever ideas around that. So trying to rule out that it's impossible, that there could be that's why I'm saying that you have to be careful what assumptions go into those kinds of statements. But let me sort of say, so the other thing we can try and do is to work on a parameterized description for the equation of state. And then instead of sampling in the tidal parameters, we can sample in the equation of state parameters and derive the tidal parameters from the masses for those equation of state parameters, so we can constrain the underlying equation of state directly. And one of the things that this does, it allows us to explicitly link to things like the maximum observed mass and derive implications for that. So one of the things we start to see then is if we look at the radius derived from these observations, we find that the gravitational wave data alone favors really small radius stars, well, 11-kilometer stars, which is on the small side here. But there is sort of a long tail. And if we use our parameterization to try and enforce that we also have to support an almost 2 solar mass star, that actually rules out a chunk of this parameter space that's giving these compact stars, and it shifts the distribution over. So what used to be a little tail here is actually an equal hump, and we end up with this posterior distribution for the radius of the neutron star. So that's what I was saying, that the gravitational wave data alone really pushes you towards a set of equations of state that are almost in tension with currently observed maximum mass stars. However, it's well within sort of the error bars that you might expect from random noise fluctuations. There's no real tension here. It's just that the gravitational wave range is tilted towards a very compact neutron star, which can be puzzling to explain with current sort of nuclear physics proposals. So we can also then, using the parameterized equation of state, you directly see what this means for the pressure inside the neutron star. And one of the things to emphasize is the central pressures of the stars in these models are not as high as the pressure that you need to know about to enforce that we reach 1.97 neutron stars. Solar 1.97 solar mass neutron stars. So what we end up seeing in our implications for the equation of state is that the gravitational wave data pushes things down at roughly twice, two or three times nuclear density, but requiring the support of massive stars pushes things upwards. And and so with and without maximum mass, you get a decrease in the implications for higher density stars. So one of the things this might suggest is that the neutron stars are compact, but there's some sort of phase transition at high density, which allows these high maximum mass stars to be supported. If you're starting to think about things like that, then you could also potentially have a stable hypermassive neutron star remnant after the things collide. One nice thing about these results is the implications for the pressure at saturation density here tend to overlap X-ray constraints that had previously been observed, but that had concerns about systematic error in the modeling of X-ray bursts. So we're able to kind of sidestep that, or not sidestep that, we're able to inform this question of astrophysical observations of neutron star mergers, or of neutron star radii, in a way that at least has entirely independent systematic curves. So I'll just highlight one of the things that a summer student of mine was able to check this year was that the gravitational wave signal really only depends on above nuclear density physics. So we actually are insensitive to any assumptions we make about what's going on in the crust of the neutron stars. This is really a dense matter probe. So this is a useful set of information that's independent of what's going on in the crust of the neutron star and only is sensitive to the high densities where most of the matter is and most of the gravitational potential is generated. This also has an implication that our radius estimates have some systematic uncertainty from that unconstrained crust variation that we can't really probe with the gravitational wave signal.
Question?
Yeah.
How much of the Richter radius is then unknown? Is it like the outer 90% that is fluffy, or just 10% that is fluffy?
It's 10% or less. It's this sort of unknown crust. And the thickness, this is basically saying the thickness of crust is could vary by about 0.3 kilometers from the core that is sort of known or more restricted. I'm going to skip a lot of discussion about systematic error because I want to spend the last couple minutes just talking about where we're going next. So the goal for the next few years is to improve the binary neutron star range by a factor of 2 and the high frequency sensitivity potentially by a factor of 5, which has a big implication for what we would be able to learn about neutron star matter from this high frequency tidal signature. The current rate estimates are consistent with sort of long-lasting expectations that we could see roughly 40 neutron stars a year with advanced LIGO at design sensitivity, although there's, you know, plenty of space for variation within the range that's compatible with the current observation. So we've got about an order of magnitude variation around that 40 per year. So currently, this is the calendar years have shifted a little bit. So we just finished O2. We're in a flat commissioning phase. The idea is that we'll turn on around 2019 for something that will have 15 times the volume times time, or the rate of the first observing run, or about 3 times the rate of the second observing run. So this is where that 1 to 10 range of the kind of numbers of neutron star mergers we expect to observe next year comes from. But it's worth pointing out that there's another commissioning period and then another design period, and there's currently a prospect of upgrading even within the LIGO facilities to a sort of an advanced LIGO plus configuration that would continue the sensitivity getting to, 200 times the number of neutron stars observed in the last observing run, which sounds a lot. So we're now almost worried that we might have too much data. No, not really. I think I will just stop there so I have some time for people to ask questions.
Two questions. So, first, on that last point, you'll have far more events, but does this also mean that we expect to have events that will have a much cleaner signal, and which might be much more important than having more events?
Right. So I think in terms of So in terms of the information you can see from the signal, that's sort of what these factor of two, factor of five. So this is going to maybe the next observing run. If we saw 170817 again in the next observing run, we could get maybe a third the error bars on things of this last one. If we see something that's three times as far away, we would get comparable error bars. So when you look at these multiple observation things, typically what you find is the information is dominated by the loudest signals. At this point, you know, it's how to say. It's sort of the, so what you really care about is this high frequency sensitivity. If this improves faster than our overall sensitivity, that gives us more impact on the neutron star matter. So that could give us extra bang for the buck, no matter how many signals there are. But in terms of the rates, it's almost equivalent. The uncertainty in the rates and the uncertainty in our horizon are somewhat degenerate. So either one should have a similar effect in information available.
Second question. OK. So we analyzed the first four events looking at data and to extract a clean waveform as best we could. One of the tests we did was then to take the extracted waveform, inject it into other samples of noise, and to go through the same extraction process. And when we did that, we found that we couldn't extract the signal nearly as cleanly as we had for the primary event. In other words, the signal, the template of the signal we extracted for this primary event was highly tuned to the noise at the time of this event. And so knowing the signal and putting it into other noise, what we extracted was another clean signal, but it didn't match what we put in.
Right, so.
So this is a frequentist approach to analysis as opposed to the Bayesian approach. As far as I know, all of the analysis in determining the parameter estimation is taking use of Bayesian.
Yeah.
Analysis. And so the question is there any work that's going on? So say you've got a signal, you think this is the signal you extracted. Take that signal, put it into some other sample of noise, create a synthetic signal,
yeah.
Go through the same analysis again.
Well, so that's sort of what's done exactly for these sort of estimated systematics. There's a few places where this kind of thing is done. So certainly one of the first things we did with 170817 is start doing injection studies to take models compatible with the parameters that we were extracting, and then generate waveforms with those known parameters, and then recover them and test that we were recovering them as expected. So to do that, you need real noise. So that's something that we do look at. I think probably the most relevant paper for that would be, I believe Chris Pankow is the lead author, and it was focusing on the group glitch tests for 170817 and ensuring that the presence of glitches wasn't disrupting our parameter estimation in some messed up way. So exactly what they did was inject known signals into data that had glitches in it, and then test run the whole procedure of pulling out the glitch and then trying to extract parameters and confirming that they got back something.
Okay.
Now, I know one of the things that we definitely find is that if you're doing a study like this where you're trying to get your estimated error bars, you want to do a lot of trials because otherwise individual noise realizations can give you systematic offsets, which are and so that's a known thing that people, yeah. So that's just the offsets are expected. So you need to do a large sample size to get the confirmation that you are. And people have done that. I can't offhand know exactly which papers to point you to, but that's something that's been done a number of times. Now, for something like this, we actually do zero noise injections, where we sort of actually suppress the noise and get, well, not this. Anyway, there's ways that we actually do zero noise of the injections to avoid that effect, to estimate how big the error bars would be, just from other systematics, like waveform effects and things like that. So I'm not sure if that was helpful,
yeah.
Maybe too detailed.
Could you say a bit more about the phase transition? Is that expected just because of the tidal heating? What kind of temperature?
No, so this is just a feature of cold matter itself that we're not sure about. That right now you come in to something near nuclear density, and we expect that the degrees of freedom that describe our system are protons and neutrons, and we can describe their interactions in sort of a mini-body physics kind of way. But it's quite possible that there's some transition to, say, quark matter, where the degrees of freedom that best describe the matter interacting are say, quarks, or that there could be particle production like hyperons and things like that. And there's a lot of regions within the star where, because our knowledge of particle properties at this in these conditions are actually not very precise, there's a lot of uncertainty in exactly when, say, hyperons or particles that include a strange quark in them might be favored. And and one of the things that will change when that happens is you can get something where the equation of state, you know, is ramping up with pressure and then goes through a phase transition and changes the properties, and that would show up in the pressure density relationship as a change in slope. So one of the things that we did to extrapolate or to enforce that we reached the high maximum masses observed in astrophysical neutron stars was to extrapolate with relatively smooth equations of state up to high density, and that kind of pushed everything up to get there. But if we allowed equations of state that were more dramatically wobbly, perhaps that there would be a route from the pressure regime we constrained to another pressure regime required to support high mass stars that would have some interesting phase transition that would make a more complicated path through the pressure density plane. So that's what I'm talking about with hints about phase transitions or things like that. As the precision of astrophysical observations of neutron stars increases, we may be going through this from this unconstrained plane to something where we have to kind of thread a needle through various observations that probe various densities. And we may begin to observe interesting structure in the equation of state that give hints about particle interactions that are otherwise inaccessible.
Yeah, I was wondering, since you mentioned spinning in contrast, do you also take into account precessing systems like your precession?
Yeah, so yes. So one of things, so there you go. So you'll notice that one of these models seems to have very different behavior from the other ones, and that is specifically, this is a phenomenological precessing numerical relativity with tides calibrated model. So precession allows for some of these spin configurations that allow us to consider things that have weird out-of-plane effects. Which are not ruled out very well, which is why they get that funny bump there. So we do consider precession. We cannot make any strong statements about precession from the data available in the system. We can't really rule it out or observe it.
I mean, from the earlier cycles, the effect of precession probably be visible on the phase, but when you're coming close, there might be tidal effects which come in.
Right. So I should say that this NR tides calibrated precessing model is kind of a hybrid where the underlying precessing spin dynamics is coming from precessing binary black hole simulations. and numerical and a waveform family calibrated to those. And then the tidal contribution is overlaid on top of it. We do not have more than a couple precession neutron star merger simulations. We only have a small subset of spin configuration simulations. But the assumption, which is relatively well borne out, is those things decouple. Because, as you said, the precession is more in the earlier part and the tides are really in the final stages where they can just sort of be overlaid on whatever residual dynamics are left from the particles.
In hopes of future events, but they could choose the options because we all know about neutron stars and vibrant pulses.
Uh-huh.
Normal masses, the remnant becomes a neutron star.
Yeah, well, I mean, the
otherwise, if they continue to get events, in hopes, is it a black hole, is it a neutron star? This is rather odd,
so I mean, this system is, this is a very, very compatible with a equal mass 1.36 solar mass to 1.36 solar mass by neutron stars that then collided. So that's very much like the galactic pulsars we see. Right, so and then that's the question about what happened when these two things collided.
Yeah, because then you produce this oddball thing.
Yeah.
And
yes.
We have to say how many of those are around which we don't observe.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, and it could be a selection effect where we don't observe those, but they could be floating around in our galaxy, unless they somehow kick into another merger. We might not be able to know.
What about white dwarfs?
Well, unfortunately for LIGO, their radius is too large, so they collide before it gets into our frequency band. But, that would be a fun scenario for LISA or space-based observations.
Okay. So let's thank Jocelyn again.